Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com.
Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. Our story for July is another one with a steampunk feel to it. That is why we are happy to feature more music by one of our favorite bands, Abney Park. And speaking of Abney Park, one lucky listener is going to win their latest CD, Lost Horizons, The Continuing Adventures of Abney Park. Stick around at the end of the story to find out how you can win this fantastic CD. Our story is The Destruction of Sennacherib by Bryn Sparks from New Zealand. Our narrators for the story are Mark Pearlstone and Ali Groves, both from England. We are truly spanning the globe to bring you this one. We will have more information about all of them on our site. Now, on to our story. The Destruction of Sennacherib by Bryn Sparks. 19th century London, a place and a history much like the one we know, and yet changed. As a separatist army stands poised for war, two words will determine just how far its course will deviate. Lethal configuration. It is the key to saving an empire, or annihilating one.
I entered the spare bedroom and was surprised to see Mrs. King at the dresser wearing a man's waistcoat and dinner trousers. My housekeeper said she arrived in a deplorable state 3 days ago and, after receiving a letter, curiously delivered to her on New Year's Day, vowed she would not leave the house until my return from Edinburgh. She adjusted her cufflinks and reached for a dinner jacket hanging from the open wardrobe door. Even in the yellow gas light, I could see the high flush of a fever on her face, and her cheeks were gaunt. "So it worked. That's the longest half-hour I've ever experienced, Lady Byron," I said, trying to break the moment. Yet apart from the privations of her obvious illness and her unusual choice of wearing a man's clothing, she looked not a day older than when I had last seen her all those years ago. She turned, and her eyes widened with some surprise at the sight of me. She covered her shock with a rueful smile.
"You've grown distinguished, James."
She was still the most comely woman I had ever known. Despite being in my sixth decade, I could appreciate her beauty every bit as much as the infatuated young man I had been when I last laid eyes on her.
"For me, it's been hardly longer than that. Sit. Let me finish dressing and we'll go downstairs. I have a tale to tell you, but..."
"Dear God," I said. "You said as if you had merely been on a train trip." She raised her hand.
"I implore you, for the love of that same God you've just invoked, no more. I'll not speak of it until you've eaten. You've travelled far yourself today, and I want you to tell me what's become of our friends. Tell me. Tell me as if I, like you, had truly only been on a train trip."
And so I did. The enormity of the accomplishment overwhelmed me. A concern for her beat fiercely in my breast as I accompanied Mrs. King back downstairs into the dining room. My housekeeper gave no sign. She knew better than to make a scene in front of a guest, however outlandish the guest might be. But I knew I would be in for a scolding from her tomorrow morning. Despite the lateness of the evening, it was only half an hour more until we had a generous supper of turbot and potatoes with white sauce, asparagus and carrots. Throughout the meal, Mrs. King and I had a somewhat one-sided conversation, during which I regaled her with the news of half a century. Then she plied me with questions about the doings of our mutual friends from all those years ago, when she bought this house for us and provided funds for our experiments. She had insisted then we not address her as Countess or Lady Byron. Using her married name back then was our private joke, since she was in her late 30s and we in our early 20s, and we all secretly loved her, even Podge, despite his being a fop. Over and over, it was as if she were asking two questions when I thought her asking only one.
Did Stephen gain his membership in the Royal Society for his...
She asked, for example, trailing off as she lifted a fork to her mouth. And I would answer, relating how Stephen was indeed now a member of the Royal Society, and his work in orthopaedics was regarded among the finest. But it happened often during the conversation like that. She would ask about so-and-so.
Who is doing...
And she would never complete the second part, as if she were afraid of my answer. For, of course, half a century takes a toll on any group of friends, and more than once I had to tell her of friends who had long since passed away. Eventually, the meal concluded, and we went through to the lounge, I pulling on the bell pull as we passed, to let my housekeeper know she could come and clean up. I poured myself a brandy and offered Mrs. King a sherry, but she laughed and took a whiskey instead. I tapped my pipe on the grate and then filled it and lit it. We sat, and I looked at her with open curiosity. "Well then, have I satisfied your appetite for gossip?" I asked.
"You have certainly satisfied my appetite for a fine meal."
She smiled, and I puffed on my pipe. At last she leaned forward, her features lit more by the fire in the hearth than by the gas lights.
"Yes. You've been most patient, and I shall keep you wondering no longer. But so much has happened in such a short time. Things are not perhaps so bad as I feared at first upon my arrival, but let me tell you of my strange journey and decide for yourself. You were always the most level-headed of the group, James. And the fact you had faith in me and stayed here at Richmond all these years speaks well of you."
I flushed at that. My own experimentation had come to nothing. And when the others left to pursue their own various careers and lives, I could never decide if I stayed through sheer inertia or if indeed, as she said, I kept the home fires burning in the hope she might one day return.
"I need to tell this in my own way, and I ask that you not interrupt me once I start."
"Of course," I replied, swirling my brandy before taking a large sip. My hand was trembling. She nodded and began her tale.
"Very well. The first thing you need to know is that although it's been 50 years for you since the morning I left, barely a week has passed for me. Having seen the machine appear as it should, when we sent it preset for a journey of a day, I determined to prove to you all, beyond doubt, the machine works safely with a human occupant, as I said it would. I knew at once I needed to bring back something from the future, something recognisably from a particular time. It struck me it might be rather clever to travel 50 years forward to the turn of the century. I would bring you all back a copy of the Pall Mall Gazette or the London Times, dated January the 1st, 1901. That and photographs of the celebrations would do the trick, or nothing would. I remember telling you I had to step out and I would be back in half an hour. And so I entered the machine while the rest of you were still smoking cigars and drinking brandy in celebration of our success that day, full of resolve and good humour. I set the dials and engaged the engine that propelled the machine forward through time. At once the sensation of falling seized me, and I saw you enter the laboratory. Podge joined you from the doorway to the garden with his young friend, but all three of you moved with such speed it seemed comedic to me, and I laughed. You raced around the laboratory, and through the window I saw the sun similarly race across the sky. Night followed quickly, and then a few seconds later, day again. Parts of the laboratory blurred, and the transition from night to day and back again was like the beating wings of a vast bat, membranous and leathery, yet rapid. The stars whirled so quickly, they traced circles in the flickering sky. The sun settled into a blazing path across the dark blue sky, and moved ponderously through the course of weeks, and then months. I did not panic, and so was able to appreciate the beauty of the seasons, marching through their implacable advance, Snow appeared and disappeared. Trees flickered into green and then red and brown, and I marvelled to see them stretch and reach for the heavens with their swelling branches. But I knew I had to control my momentum, and so rotated the brass dials, slowing my progress. The sun and moon became discernible once more as discrete lights, and as the counters informed me, I was approaching the winter of 1900, snow blanketing the garden outside. I slowed my progress still further, and the mad whirling of the brass engine on my machine slowed the passage of days to a crawl. In moments, I passed through December 31st, and I brought the machine to a stop. It was evening, and the clock in the hallway chimed 11. Outside, snow fell in a thick blanket, and the sky glowed with the lights of the city, reflected from the bottom of roiling clouds. London. The new Rome. They say all roads lead to London. That's certainly true if you're anywhere in Grand Britain. I could hear the roar of the city, a city poised to celebrate itself. A city that was the pearl in a world-spanning empire. I crawled out of the machine, marvelling at the brass and ivory. It seemed to me then to be a thing of great beauty we'd constructed, not merely a thing of utility and purpose. I listened at the door leading from the laboratory to the hallway, lest I inadvertently encounter some version of myself, native to this year, or the house's new occupants, it suddenly occurred to me, for who knew where my success with the machine might lead upon my return to you and the others in 1852? I recalled our endless debates over the theoretical risks of time travel within one's own lifetime. As easily as I had dismissed them then, so now I found myself giving them sudden credence, lest they transpire to be true. Hearing nothing, I stepped out and made my way quietly toward the front door. Piccadilly Circus was the place I was most likely to get good photographs of revellers that might also include displays of the date. Even in the time period I left you all, when the Empire was still exploding with the first fruits of the age of thinking machines, Christmas crowds gathered beneath the giant cinema engine screens that counted down to the new year. And this year was 1 in 100. As I passed the hallway table, I noticed a copy of the Pall Mall Gazette. I picked it up and tucked it under my arm as I made my way out into the fresh falling snow and the night. I wore my coat, and in my pocket I had my camera. Unfortunately, my gloves lay back in 1852. I left on a summer morning, so winter had been far from my mind. The cold night numbed my hands as I trudged down to Wentworth Street to hail an electric hansom. The driver looked like a typical Robotnik from my own time. His wooden face waxed and polished to a rich sheen, showing off the grain, even in the strange light of the nighttime city. In the 1850s, his kind were touted as the harbingers of Utopia. I was never sure how true such assertions might be, but I knew the iron grip with which Britannia held her colonies in the Americas and Africa and India was iron indeed. Robotnik infantrymen possessed none of the good humour displayed by worker classes, such as the driver.
"Cold night out, ma'am,"
he exclaimed from atop his bench. He wore a muffler and a thick duffel coat, and it struck me then as singularly strange a man made of wood and metal, whose thoughts were nothing more than a microscopic turning of thousands of analytical engines, that such a creature should have need of protection from the cold at all. But of course, it was an affectation. Even in my own year, the roboter adopted the mannerisms and style of fleshmen. Abolitionists claim they did so in an attempt to affirm their belief in our brotherhood under God, but the rate of development of microscopic analytical engines was such, I wondered how clever they might have become during the last 50 years. "It is that driver," I replied, as he opened the cab door. I stepped into warmth and a pleasant glow. The seats gave off the welcome aroma peculiar to leather, and the brass fixtures gleamed.
"Where to then, ma'am?"
the driver's voice issued from a brass grill. "Piccadilly Circus," Robotnik laughed as the electric hansom lifted off the ground and accelerated smoothly to a trot.
"You and half London, m'lady."
"Good crowds there then, driver?" I asked, putting the newspaper down to rub my cold hands.
"That there is, love. I nearly made enough from this night to buy me freedom twice over.
We both laughed at the unlikely joke. Robota was still mostly indentured then, it seemed, and I found myself strangely comforted by the thought. Women's suffrage had followed hard on the heels of the advent of the Robotnik, and I was old enough to remember things had been very different for the women of my mother's generation. I suspect I, like many others, feared Robota suffrage might turn back the clock for women.
You're not bunkering down for the virus then, love?
Virus?
Call me, lovely. Where have you been lately then? The moon? The virus? What them bleeding hawks from India's is going to release to bring down the engine net? And all the Queen's men besides?
Ah, I see. No, I'm not bunkering down, I said. But my mind was racing. Outside, I could see the snow had stopped falling, and the sky was clear in patches. For all that, I couldn't see the stars. Instead, the night was full with the glittering lights of London's skyscrapers, enormous black shapes looming as monumental reminders of Grand Britain's majesty and power. Between them, visible more by the sweeping searchlight beams playing down over the city, an imperial air dreadnought eased its own ponderous bulk. I gaped at the scale. Everything seemed twice as large, and twice as high, and twice as massive as in my own time. I glanced down at the newspaper lying on the seat beside me, and for the first time, noticed the headline. Sikh separatist army threatened virus to end empire. I glanced through the story. It seemed the original analytical engine, the mechanical computer designed and built by my friend and mentor, the great Charles Babbage in the 1830s, had a lethal configuration that could lock up an entire engine if it were ever presented with the right sequence of calculations. The article went on to describe how all the miniaturized analytical engines at the heart of the Empire's technology were just small versions of the original analytical engine. No one had ever changed the fundamental arrangement of cogs and gears and drivetrains and clutches. They had just been made smaller and linked together in greater numbers, so here at the turn of the century, I could be driven in a cab by a man whose very thoughts were determined by the workings of billions of microscopic versions of Babbage's original design, all operating in parallel. But therein lay the threat. The article went on to say, the Sikh separatist army had threatened London, declaring they had cracked the starting sequence for the lethal configuration. The army planned to release a virus into the net to bring down the empire. I got to the end of the article and smiled to myself. As I suspected, the Royal Society had issued a statement saying the threat was a hoax and no such configuration existed. I agreed with the Society. I myself had helped Charles develop the language to produce instruction sets for his engines, and I had never had any hint of such a thing. I closed the paper and sat back down in my seat as we neared our destination. How could one be alarmist in the midst of the glorious capital of Grand Britain, as she prepared to stride into the new century, secure in the iron grip of Pax Britannia? And then we came into view of Piccadilly Circus and the crowd. My God, the people! I have never seen so many jammed together. The very air thrummed and groaned with the effort of having to be breathed in and out through so many mouths at once.
Here you are, then, love. Can't take you no closer. This do, though?
Yes, it's fine. And I smiled up at his face. Some of the snow had melted and formed drops of water, sparkling and glistening on the polished wood, reflecting the chaos of light filling Piccadilly Circus. I signed his proffered chip to indicate his master he had completed my fare, and then turned back to look over the heads of the seething mass of people towards the giant cinema engine screen, counting down towards midnight. Ironically, I had only just arrived in time with less than 5 minutes to go. I made my way toward a cluster of women in top hats and fur coats, preferring to rub shoulders with people of my own class. I was pushed and shoved, but managed to keep hold of my newspaper. I quickly realized that to get the photograph I wanted, I would have to take it from where I was. Above us, the Imperial Air Dreadnought hove closer, The massive armor plates glistened with reflected light, and the giant guns bristling along the length of the battle deck. The armored flight envelope itself put most buildings to shame, hundreds of feet long, filling the sky. I pulled my camera from my pocket and snapped one or two shots of the airship. The crowd roared with one voice. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the lights went out. I swear to God, I heard my heart beat in my chest then. My eyes were blind with a sudden darkness, although I had a vague impression of twinkling lights in vastly distant parts of the city, winking out as if a black cloak were being cast over them all. And then the crowd gave voice to our deepest and most primal fear, the all-consuming night. I was jerked forward with an irresistible mass of bodies, all screaming and yelling their terror. And then, just as irresistibly, the crowd forced me backwards, so it was all I could do to keep on my feet. As my eyes adjusted to the darkness, I saw scores of people fall, only to be trampled underfoot. No one could resist the surging tide we were all part of. No one could pause to help others to their feet. I realized my luck to have arrived so late. Being on the edge of the crowd, I was swept out and away from the seething maelstrom of people trapped in the square. I had the presence of mind to look up and back, and what I saw chilled my marrow in my bones more than any winter night. The virus had caught the Imperial Air Dreadnought just as surely as it had the rest of London. The searchlights were dimmed and the running lights were off. A black leviathan with blind portholes for eyes, falling with dreadful slowness from the sky. I turned from the sight of things and concentrated on staying upright amid the shove and push of the crowd fleeing Piccadilly. And then, from behind, I heard even above the cacophony of human voices, metal tearing, ammunitions detonating, an infernal screech so loud it felt as if it were adding its weight to the force of the crowd pushing me along. A man beside me was screaming something, trying to be heard, but none could hear him above the noise of the stricken airship colliding with the mass of struggling humanity behind us. I saw the man fighting the tide of people, struggling towards an alley between two large buildings. I did not hesitate in making my effort to follow him, clawing and kicking my way towards the deeper darkness of the narrow gap. As I reached him, he leaned out of the deeper darkness and pulled me down beside him. He squatted with his back against the wall of the building closest to the square, and he let go of me to crouch forward and cover his head with his hands. It suddenly dawned on me what he was doing, and I mimicked his posture. The explosion, when it came, was like a door opening on hell. Even with my head bowed and my eyes squeezed shut, I saw unbearable bright white, quickly followed by red, as when your eyes are gouged. The ground leapt beneath us, and an inferno of insane fire roared up the mall, snuffing out tens of thousands of lives in the blink of an eye. The building against which I'd braced myself disintegrated, and something struck my head, a brick, I suppose, which rendered me unconscious. I awoke to daylight. I found out later it must have been the next day, because it took me 3 days to make my way back to the house in Richmond, a trip of less than an hour in the electric hansom the night before. According to my machine, the date upon my return was January the 4th. More snow fell while I lay senseless that first night, but ironically, the covering of warm ash that threatened me with suffocation had also saved me from freezing. My companion, the man who I followed into the alley, lay dead beside me. He'd been buried not just in ash, but also bricks and rubble from the devastated buildings between which we'd sought shelter. Fragments of burnt skeletons covered us also. I say it took me 3 days to return to my house, but I will speak only briefly of that nightmarish trip. Civilization had been ripped from us in a single stroke at midnight. airships crashed down across the entire city. The giant Maxwell Motors could not reverse gravity without functional analytical engines to control the electromagnetic fields. And without anti-gravity assistance, the giant war machines, pride of the Imperial Air Navy, became so many bombs of hydrogen, drifting down to detonate amid the terrified populace of the Empire's capital. Trains had derailed. Robota had ceased to think and crashed their vehicles or destroyed their machinery. Water no longer ran. Sewerage systems backed up. Lighting and heating were gone. People took to the streets, rioting. Gangs ran, looting from Harrods to Highbridge. Women and men were raped and murdered with impunity. But the children were the worst. Their small corpses littered the streets, often with a parent grieving over them, but just as often with no one to mark their cold, hungry deaths in the dirty snow of a city dying with them. As I made the trek, I found myself repeatedly reciting a stanza from The Destruction of Sennacherib, one of my late father's poems. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed. And the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heavened and forever grew still. London was full of homeless in those days, it seemed. Valueless labour in that vaunted time of the Robota. Not such a utopia after all. They say a society can best be judged by how it treats its weakest members. In the ruins of Grand Britain, the weakest died first. I saw so many dead as I made my way back towards Richmond. When I arrived, I was footsore and weak with hunger and horror both as I trudged up the path. The riots had not been so bad around my area. Not genteel to be seen rioting, I suppose. But I knew from experience if I were to go into one of my neighbours' houses, I would find it empty or full of corpses. Everything relied on some form of analytical engine, and all of it, from the least sewerage system control unit through to the giant Maxwell motor powering London's central business district, all of it was linked by the engine net. All of it had been destroyed by the deadly virus loosed by madmen upon Imperial Britannia. I stumbled through the front door of the house and down the hallway to the laboratory. I was mad with the horrors I witnessed, but I devised a wild plan. In my coat pocket, I still carried the newspaper I picked up from that very hallway. The article it ran, relating to the virus, had given me an idea. I was a time traveller, by God. My machine was still safely in the laboratory, just as I'd left it. I pulled myself into it and sat there a moment, overcome with dizziness. I was fatigued beyond anything I'd ever experienced, both in body and soul. But if I were going to prevent the release of the virus, I needed all my resolve. I intended to race back against the clock, back to a time before my own, a thing we'd all agreed should never be done. I steeled myself, and then set the brass dials. Once again, I was thrust into the flickering ghost world of travel through time. Outside the window, I caught sight of the flashes and detonations of the New Year disaster, and then the flapping wing of night and day quickly merged into inky blue. The nausea was not so bad, although I rather suspect it may have been because I was so sick at the outset. I held my breath as the dial indicating the passage of years flashed backwards past 1852, the year of my original journey. There was a theoretical possibility my machine, or I, might disappear, but I was relieved to find we passed that date, and both the machine and I remained intact. As I approached my target date, I readjusted the dials, gently slowing my passage. The sun slowed from a pulsing band to become once more a discernible orb. I turned the dials all the way to their starting positions, and the whirling engine of the time machine came to a halt. 1834. I dismounted and stepped towards the door in the hallway. I was in a state of panic. I was fearful any chance encounter might lead to some disastrous consequence in my own time, or even worse, disrupt the nature of reality itself. I was in this time for a single purpose, and I doubt now I'd even dared that had I not been deranged from the horrors and physical privation of the previous days. But at the time, I was determined the terrorists would not be allowed to visit their evil on my world, and I would stop at nothing to thwart them. I would stop at nothing, because I had nothing to lose. You see, I blame myself for not having discerned the terminal configuration inherent in Charles's design. I blamed myself for not having warned him. I believe I held some responsibility for the horror, and the moral weight of it was more than any mortal heart could bear without breaking. Hearing only the ticking of a clock, I stepped into the hallway and moved quickly towards the study. Again, hearing nothing at the door to indicate an occupant, I went in. Although arranged quite differently than in my own time, and without the text and equipment to which I'd become accustomed, the study had a familiar feel to it. At the desk, I took up a pen and a sheet of paper. I tore the front page from the Pall Mall Gazette I'd carried with me, and I also took out my camera. Dipping the pen nib in a pot of ink, I gave Richmond as the return address, and Mrs. William King, even though at that time I had not yet purchased the house for our group, and was a year off being wed to William. And then, Charles, if you speak to me of this letter, I shall have no recollection. I can offer no explanation, but implore you to study the information in this article and apply yourself to ensuring no such exploitable flaw exists in the design of your analytical engine. See for yourself the consequences. Your humble servant, Ada Byron. I activated the print function on my camera and attached a photograph I'd taken of the body-strewn streets of London following the release of the virus into the engine net. I put the newspaper article, the photograph and the letter into a large envelope and sealed it with a wax seal, melted using a taper lit from the open fire. I addressed the envelope. Sir Charles Babbage, care of the Royal Geographical Society, London. I placed the letter with various other letters and outward correspondence for the houseman to deliver. Quickly then, and with dread rising by the moment, I made my way back to the room that would become the laboratory here in years to come. But in 1834, it was a simple conservatory, and my abiding memory of that time is the smell of potted begonias. I needed to know if my flight into the past had been successful. I had to find out if I had been believed by a man I could not risk meeting, with nothing more than a front page of a newspaper and a photograph to vouch for me. And so, instead of returning to 1852 and a rendezvous with you and the others on that evening, I came back here to 1901, to the day after the turn of the century.
The fire had died down to mere embers as she had related her tale, but she stoked it now with a fire iron. Sparks and motes danced and spun up the flue. But that's a remarkable tale. Much of what you said seemed incomprehensible to me. Maxwell declared the project a failure when you didn't return. He had always maintained we lacked the sheer mathematical power to model the field fluctuations accurately. And it was only through the good graces of your late husband, the Lord Lovelace, that some of us did not end up before the assizes, answering for your disappearance. But if I follow you correctly, you averted some sort of aeronautical disaster. A balloon of some sort and an explosion? Because nothing like that has been reported in the papers, so you must have been successful. Why have you not returned to meet with us all those years ago and tell us of your deed? The world thinks you long dead of cancer, and yet your success vindicates all our efforts.
You think so? You think I did not see the consequences of my meddling as I sped through the years? The woman you knew did fail. You think this pitiful world of gas and coal and steam and poverty and filth and barbarism is a success? And yet for all that, I dare not meddle further, lest some greater catastrophe be caused. I have destroyed the infernal time machine, and can only thank God that without Charles's engines, another will never be built.
I thought her lost to reverie, but after a minute, she took from her waistcoat pocket an unopened letter and held it out to me. The newsprint was aged and yellow and barely readable, despite being dated December 31st, 1900, only 4 days ago. The headline read, "Sikh Separatist Army Threaten Virus to End Empire." I picked up the letter and read it. January 1st, 1901. "Dear Mrs. King, at the request of Sir Charles Babbage and in accordance with his last will and testament, we, the executors of his estate, write to you on this very specific date, some 30 years after his death, with the following message from Sir Charles. Without the use of 1,000 engines, I lacked the wit to calculate the lethal configuration. Knowing what might happen were I to fail, I lacked the courage to build the first. With my deepest affection, Sir Charles Babbage, Esquire."
Broadsides bare, our cannons flare, but it's just a show of muscle. Steady engine doesn't need to.
Thank you for listening to The Destruction of Sennacherib by Bryn Sparks, narrated by Mark Pearlstone and Ali Groves, with music by Abney Park. This story also features music from a website called Laura's MIDI Heaven. If you love MIDI files that feature some very old music, that site is the place for you. In the intro, I mentioned a contest. We are giving away one Abney Park CD. Here are the rules. Send an email to variantfrequencies@gmail.com with the subject Lost Horizons Contest. In the email, you need to tell us the name of one band member from Abney Park. It is easy to find out the names of the band by going to abneypark.com. The winner will be drawn from the list of people who send us the correct answer. All entries must be in by July 31st, 2008. We will announce the winner in our podcast in August. Also in August is one of the biggest sci-fi and fantasy conventions around, DragonCon. Abney Park will be playing there. If you are going to be at DragonCon, let us know. Anne and I are both going to be there. We'd love to meet you. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like Variant Frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you from the Variant Frequencies team, Matt Wallace, Anne Stringer, and Rick Stringer.
Hi, this is Matthew Wayne Selznick. My podcast novel, Brave Men Run, is a superpowered coming-of-age story that's equal parts Breakfast Club and X-Men. And I'm very proud to say it's being published by Swarm Press in a brand new paperback edition on Sunday, July 13, 2008. On that Sunday, July 13th, I'm asking you to visit Amazon.com and purchase Brave Men Run. I want your help to push Brave Men Run to the top of the Amazon.com bestseller charts. My goal is attention. Attention for Brave Men Run, attention for Swarm Press, attention for new media, and mainly, attention for you, because you're the ones who decide what gets listened to, what gets watched, and what gets read. And this time, we're not going to leave any doubts in the minds of traditional publishers. I'm asking you to make a commitment on Sunday, July 13th, and I will make a commitment to you. I will be with you all day, live on streaming video, every hour, on the hour, in a Brave Men Run book release webathon. Beginning at 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific time, you'll get updates on the book's progress. We'll chat together in a dedicated chat room, and I will read to you brand new short fiction set in the universe of Brave Men Run from these powerhouse podcast authors: J.R. Blackwell, Nathan Lowell, Jared Axelrod, P.G. Holyfield, Matt Wallace, Murr Lafferty, and J.C. Hutchins, with his first work of non-Seventh Son fiction ever. Join me on live video on Sunday, July 13th, 2008. Purchase Brave Men Run from Amazon.com on that day. Listen to brand new fiction. And together, with your help, we will see podcasting and publishing history made. For more information, visit mattselznick.com or bravemenrun.com.
In Void City, the vampires run the town, the cops are on the take, and the werewolves have found religion. But Eric doesn't give a damn about any of that. He just wants to run his club, drink a little blood, and be left alone. Yeah, not gonna happen. After killing a werewolf in self-defense one Friday night, Eric is in for one hell of a hard time. He must survive car crashes, enchanted bullets, sunlight, sex magic, and werewolves on ice, not to mention his own nasty temper and forgetfulness. Because being undead isn't easy, but it sure beats the alternative. Take a tour of Void City in Staked by J.F. Lewis, a debut urban fantasy novel from Pocket Books. If you like what you read, make a return visit in 2009 for the sequel, Revamped. Pick them up wherever books are sold. And don't forget to check out Jeremy's website at www.authoratlarge.com. You can also find him goofing off at the League of Reluctant Adults with fellow urban fantasy writers Mark Henry, Anton Strout, Stacia Kane, Jay Wells, Caitlin Kittredge, and Jackie Kessler.
Do you like science? How about general knowledge and trivia? If you do, then the Brains Matter podcast is the show for you. Brains Matter is a show about interesting topics from the world of knowledge, from science to philosophy, and from history to astronomy, together with interviews with various brainy people. So why not listen into the show, learn something new, and then share it with your mates? So come and join the ordinary guy and subscribe to the Brains Matter podcast today. Follow the instructions at the website www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. Come and join in the learning.
And not to mention the fun.
Promo number 4. So, Rich.
Earl.
I hear we have a show, huh?
Yeah, it's a great show. It's good times.
It's supposed to be really good.
It is. I like to eat garp when I'm listening to Requiem of the Outcast. It's a good show.
Where could I find that show?
You can actually find that show at requiemoftheoutcast.com.
You know, I didn't want to listen to it before, but it just sounds so exciting, I think I should. Requiemoftheoutcast.com.
It's so exciting, it's changed my outlook on life. And made me more excitable. Good times. Good times.
RequiemoftheOutcast.com. Just 5 more minutes.
Ugh.